Hello and welcome to the Science for Policy podcast. My name's Toby, and today I'm joined by Caitlin Chin Rothman. Caitlin is a fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. She researches the impact of technology on geopolitics and society. Her current interests include the relationships between data brokers and government agencies, the evolution of news in the digital era, and the role of technology platforms in countering online harmful content. Before taking up her current role, she also worked as a research analyst at the Brookings Institution, where she mainly analysed developments in US privacy and antitrust legislation. So, Caitlin, hi, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Toby.
So, from that list I've just read, you don't shy away from the big topics. How did you get interested in this stuff?
It was actually kind of an accident. So I've been interested in government and public service my entire life. And around 2016, 2017, so I was back in school at the time, and I was taking classes in how the legislative process works, how the U.S. government works. And this was around the time of the 2016 election. This was around the time when we were starting to see the role that social media plays in disseminating information about elections and about politics. And we saw that social media was actually changing the way in which people got their news and communicated with others. And I started working in the technology space. I actually worked for the government relations departments of a couple of companies. But then I realized that I was actually really interested in how technology policy itself works, especially since the United States and so many other countries around the world are going through processes where we're trying to figure out, like, how do we deal with this explosion of personal information that's being collected? How do we deal with the effects of technology on society, especially since we as a society are evolving so significantly in response to mobile devices and mobile apps and social media platforms. So I just kind of stuck around in this area ever since. Around 2019, I started working at the Brookings Institution, which is a think tank in Washington, D.C., on data privacy and social media issues. And then in 2022, I joined the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which is another Washington, D.C. think tank working on these same issues. So I definitely stumbled into this field by accident, but I think it's also because technology is this field that impacts everybody, like every single person. And that's one of the reasons why I just find it so fascinating.
Right. I bet you're not the only person who was studying or making career decisions about the time of the 2016 election in the US who got kind of sucked in by all those issues that it brought up, of which there were many, of course. But yeah, this whole question of where people got their information and how that was changing the voting process and the political process.
Absolutely. I mean, it was a huge turning point. Prior to the 2016 election, there was this feeling of optimism around social media companies. A lot of policymakers and a lot of members of the public really thought that social media could be this new and innovative way to help people communicate around political elections. And that's still true. Social media definitely helps people amplify their voices. But after 2016, I think we really started to see that social media also has major challenges that we as a society have yet to collectively address. For example, social media allows false information to spread very widely and very quickly, more so than we've seen in the past. We've also seen that social media allows harmful information to spread. And so, well, we've identified these major policy issues, but what do we do about it? Is it a question of the platforms themselves being more transparent about how they deal with this content, or are other regulatory interventions necessary? And we have seen some governments, including the European Union, take major steps in this area in recent years. But in the United States, there's still very much ongoing debates on how do we deal with the effects of technology on society.
Yeah, great. Well, so I'd like to talk more about that, obviously, and the relationship between those kinds of changes and the role then of evidence and science in policymaking. But just before we get there, you work for the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Okay, that's a pretty vague name for an organization. But if I had to guess, I'd guess it was something to do with international security or that kind of thing, or defense. Is this issue of science and society and politics a main part of their work too?
Yeah, so that's absolutely correct. The Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, is probably the most well-known as a national security think tank. It was founded as a national security think tank back in 1962 at the height of the Cold War. And CSIS has traditionally focused on defense and national security, but recently has been increasing programs outside of that scope. And so today, CSIS does work on this wide range of policy topics. And so my portfolio actually is not the main focus of CSIS. I primarily focus on issues like privacy and human rights and communication. So I study how technology impacts people and society and the way in which people access information and news in this really changing, evolving landscape. This is actually a fairly new topic to CSIS's portfolio, but it goes to show that CSIS is evolving along with the rest of the world.
Okay, great. Well, good to know. So let's start off with the big picture stuff that you've already somewhat gestured at. You said you study the relationship between news, technology, and society, and that's changed a lot, or is maybe changing right now still quite dramatically. So paint me a picture here. What is changing exactly? What does the landscape look like now compared to, I don't know, let's say pre-2016 or whenever? And what does that mean for us as people living through that change?
Yeah, I think first of all, I should say that the way in which people are getting their news is really changing because of technology. I mean, I think once upon a time, people got their news from very centralized locations like cable television or a newspaper. But today, people can get their news really from a really broad range of sources like social media or Google searches or group messaging, or television, or radios, or celebrities and influencers that we follow. So we really have news traveling a lot more quickly now and from many more sources. And on one hand, this does allow people to express opinions and to connect with others, which is a good thing. But, or you can probably imagine how easy it is for conspiracy theories to spread, or even for real information to be taken out of context, or even for news just to be reported before we have the proper fact-checking procedures or really even know what's going on. We just live in an area of very real-time communications where we're getting news essentially 24/7. But technology has also changed the news platforms itself. And in a way, news and technology have this very interdependent relationship, but it's not an equal relationship. On the one hand, we see that social media allows journalists to build up more of a platform. We're seeing news agencies evolve to put their articles online and reach more people in that manner. So in some ways, news companies do actually benefit from technology. But on the other hand, we're also seeing that technology companies have significantly more power over news agencies, especially the large search engines or social media platforms that the EU calls gatekeepers that can tailor their algorithm to choose what users see or what affects traffic and advertising dollars. And it's really interesting because technology companies and news are both competing for advertising dollars.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way. So these two entities, social media and news outlets, are both basically chasing the same source of funding, advertising money. And then if one at the same time becomes a gatekeeper to the other, of course you end up with a pretty distorted landscape. I mean, I'm not as young as you maybe, so I did some undergraduate teaching 10 or 12 years ago in media ethics and media studies. And, you know, back then my main focus was newspapers and TV. And I sometimes wonder if I was making that course again now for students who are about to graduate, would I even mention newspapers?
It's changed so dramatically. Maybe at a local context, many people do still read their local newspaper or turn to local news. The problem is we are seeing that local newspapers in general are struggling. In the United States, I think the statistic is that two local newspapers close every week. I mean, the two main pillars of funding essentially are advertisements and subscriptions. And there's only a limited pot of subscription dollars. Most people won't pay for more than one or two subscriptions. And for advertising, technology companies really have changed the advertising field so dramatically. Now we are seeing that digital advertising, personalized advertising, advertising technology has really become the future of the field, where large technology companies just have a much more precise ability to collect personal information for people and then target ads more with more detail than a small local newspaper can.
Yeah. I mean, I can see if you're looking to buy advertising, the smart way to spend your money is in some kind of technologically mediated, personalized advertising online, right? And not in buying generic space on page 17 of your local newspaper. But then I guess the papers enter a kind of death spiral, because if fewer people buy newspapers, then the ad space they're selling is less appealing to advertisers, which means less income there.
Yes.
And then if the papers have less income, the quality goes down and even fewer people buy it. So they lose both sources of income in lockstep.
It's a vicious cycle. Yes, it is a death spiral. But on the other hand, we really need to have reliable, centralized sources of information that people can turn to really understand what's going on with the world. But if newspapers are struggling, if we're seeing especially local newspapers closing, it just becomes significantly harder for people online to figure out what's real, what's reliable, and what's true.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, just because we need some institution to play that role of holding people accountable, that doesn't mean that it needs to be a newspaper in a traditional sense, does it?
I mean, it doesn't have to be played by like a traditional newspaper. And I think besides news outlets, other actors that could potentially provide this accountability function are researchers or independent academics, for example. We're also seeing news diversify. So instead of just having our traditional journalists at the big outlets, we're also seeing the rise of like independent writers like Substackers, for example, or digital journalists or bloggers or podcasters like us. So it's not just the news outlets. But I think one of the advantages of newspapers are, first of all, they're independent, or at least in many countries. There's a strong barrier between the press and the government. So the idea is that a free and independent press is able to hold institutions accountable without bias. And of course, there are other institutions that could play this function as well. I would say I just think it's important to have very diverse sources of information. The big technology companies themselves could potentially play a fact-checking role in some way. And we have seen some social media companies like assign fact-checking labels to misinformation or even take down false or harmful posts. But what happens when it comes to the need to hold big technology companies accountable, for example? Like, we saw that newspapers reported on issues like Cambridge Analytica and other major technology events. Like, in those instances, it's really important to have third parties that are also able to provide that role in informing the public.
Yeah, so a diverse landscape is a way to keep things balanced.
I think that's the idea, at least. And I think that's the idea with social media as well. I mean, you have people expressing their opinion online, but then you have others who are also countering that. And the idea is that whichever opinion is the strongest or the most true would hold out, although that doesn't always happen in practice.
Yeah, sure. I mean, but this is a familiar argument that we now know with hindsight didn't work, right? I mean, the optimism in the early days of social media was that this would be a way to democratize news and the public conversation, so that instead of having these gatekeepers, media outlets, editors or whatever, who were the ones responsible for deciding what we knew and what counted as true and so on, we would have this big open space where everyone could put across their opinion, and it would kind of self-regulate, and the most useful or the most accurate or the least crazy views kind of win out. And you see this still in things like Wikipedia, which basically runs on that principle, right? Anybody can contribute and write whatever they want on Wikipedia, but the idea is that by opening it up to everyone in a democratic way, the stuff that shouldn't be there ends up not being there because it's removed, and you get a gradual increase in quality.
Exactly.
And that's the idea. But I'm not sure there are many people left who feel optimistic about that anymore. And I think the argument that's usually made now is that what we've done is we haven't got rid of the gatekeepers and democratized it. We've just replaced one lot of gatekeepers, the kind of quality control of the newspaper editor, for instance, with another gatekeeper, namely an algorithm.
Exactly. Yes, we still have gatekeepers. It's just the gatekeepers have shifted a little bit. And these algorithms, I should add, are incredibly powerful just because they do really determine what people see online, especially algorithms from search engines and social media companies. And especially on social media, a lot of companies do have incentives to maximize user engagement with their algorithms. So, and by doing so, they also maximize user screen time, data collection, and then advertising dollars. And so some, I mean, companies have each designed their algorithms differently. We've seen that some companies have chosen to promote content from a person's network, like their family or their friends. Other companies have chosen to promote content that they predict that a user would enjoy, maybe based on their past viewing history or their demographics or other predicted interests. But in general, companies really do have an incentive to keep people hooked and engaged on content on their platform, which can sometimes lead to people engaging with like real and trustworthy news, but it could also mean that people can engage with things like conspiracy theories, or people can potentially encounter false news that has been suggested to them, especially if a person's friend or family member posts it. There has been research that suggests that people are more likely to believe misinformation shared by somebody who they know and trust.
Okay. Well, look, this is a super interesting conversation, and I want to start to make it clear to our very patient listeners why I think it's important to have this conversation on a podcast about the interaction between evidence and policy. And to start with, it's because we're talking here about the way that information, whether that's benign, accurate information or like horrible, manipulative lies, the way it makes its way from its source to its audience. And you explained very nicely that we now have this complex ecosystem where the incentives for gatekeepers, as you put it, are no longer to communicate accurately the truth. Although I do think it's an open question how much they ever were, actually. I mean, certainly with the private print media, the business model has always been to maximize subscriptions, to maximize advertising value. But now you've got these incentives, which are basically about the algorithm providing the news that it thinks is going to maximize attention and re-engagement. And that doesn't really align well with wanting to communicate only accurate information.
Yeah.
And this matters when it comes to policymaking, I think for several reasons, but not least of those is the fact that policymakers are also, you know, human beings, citizens. They themselves live and breathe this ecosystem and have to make sense of it. And I did think the obvious question to ask you next would be, all right, how do policymakers, how do any of us, figure out which sources are trustworthy and evidence-based and which are not? But now I'm suddenly very worried, based on what you've just been saying, that this is a really naive question that belongs back in, I don't know, 2015. Because it's all very well to say we need to educate people to spot misinformation or identify reliable sources. But if people are not being exposed to reliable sources at all because the algorithm doesn't provide it, then you can educate them all you like about how to spot a fake photo or how to distinguish a fake quote from a real one. But it isn't really going to help, is it?
Yeah, I mean, it's becoming harder and harder. I mean, in general, the reliable sources are things like academics or government institutions and or news outlets. This isn't universal, of course, even within those broad categories. There are still some entities that might be more or less reliable. And also, of course, no source is completely 100% infallible. We have seen that even the most reliable sources can sometimes make mistakes. And even if they issue a correction, people don't always see that correction. So there are reliable sources that people can turn to, often by going to the direct source, like an organization's website, as opposed to finding it on social media. I think the problem, though, is with the new and diverse online landscape, even though this does allow more people to communicate and express their thoughts, which is really great for promoting that freedom of opinion and thought, on the other hand, it also means that there are a lot of sources out there that look very, very reliable that might not actually be reliable. Like sources like even fake news outlets we've seen pop up in past elections. We also have seen people post screenshots that appear to be very real, but actually are taken out of context or even doctored. So even though there are still reliable sources that people can turn to, it's become much harder, I would say, to distinguish between them, especially since the average person, I mean, probably looks at each social media post for only a few seconds, right? And if you're on social media for a few hours every day, that's quite a lot of posts. Like, we're just being bombarded by information. And I really do think that it's so hard for people to fact check everything that we see when there's just this overload of news that we're being overwhelmed with.
All right, well, then let's talk about science communication. And you can pick your favorite example here, right? If it's climate change or, I don't know, whatever you like. An example where scientific information gets passed through from source to destination. What are the dynamics at play there?
Yeah, I think climate change is a really good example, just because we have seen a lot of climate change misinformation online. We've also seen misinformation in the healthcare field, particularly around the pandemic recently, as well as misinformation about very like hot button political issues like immigration or like diversity, equity, inclusion. Those are probably some of the biggest issues that we're seeing in the United States, but I think we're also seeing these trends worldwide as well. A lot of these online narratives are rooted in offline biases or perhaps beliefs that existed even long before the rise of social media. And now social media allows these narratives to spread much more quickly. So, for example, in the United States, there's long been policymakers who have denied the impact of climate change without any basis in scientific evidence and have ignored like the scientific studies that do show the impacts of carbon emissions and human behavior. We have seen online both high profile accounts as well as just like regular people posting that like climate change is a hoax. And often there's actually no sourcing in these posts. So it's not necessarily like they're citing real studies, but then warping the information. We're just seeing a lot of like very angry posts based on emotion sometimes and not just actual facts. Posts like these are sometimes very hard to take down because people can say like, oh, this is just satire. This is just opinion. But it's also very hard to predict how a person's going to respond to these posts. Like is the receiver, is the viewer of these posts going to look at this and say like, oh, this is just opinion or satire? Or is this actually something that influences people? And I would actually argue that even though it is very important, of course, to distinguish between legitimate opinion or satire, just the prevalence of this type of content could reinforce the mentality among some politicians that, oh, like many people actually oppose efforts to reduce climate change.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, politicians have always had platforms, right? If you've got a climate change denying politician, of which we thankfully have fewer over here in Europe than you have, but still, you know, a few, those people can use their platforms to spread misinformation, of course. They've always been able to do that. But I think this other point you're making is actually very interesting too, that by misinformation becoming more widespread, more visible, or at least more visible to those people the algorithm determines will find it appealing, this might be skewing policymaking directly, because policymakers, let's say naive politicians who don't have a strong settled view to start with, are going to get the impression that there's more of a groundswell of public opinion behind climate change denial, let's say, than there actually is, regardless of the factual basis or lack of it.
Exactly.
That is, they don't need to be fooled by the science or by fake science. They only need to be fooled by the impression of public opinion.
Well, you're right. Politicians have always had a platform, but for the first time, it really allows everyday voters, like, I mean, you and I, to like really engage with politicians. People can directly tweet at politicians or directly retweet or respond to comments. And I mean, policymakers or like their staff members or colleagues often do see these tweets online. Like people are very online. People are very engaged. And I do think that there's maybe some sort of, I don't know, like instant gratification maybe is the word. If a politician tweets something like climate change is a hoax, and then immediately they get like 100 likes or retweets, and even if these are just bots or just disinformation actors who are reinforcing what they're saying, if they tweet something and they get support back, I do think that reinforces their existing beliefs, even if the false belief didn't originate online, or it can reflect and even amplify what we're seeing offline.
Do you have a good idea how policymakers in general get their news and if it's different from the rest of us? I mean, we talk a lot on this podcast about science advice. And so we talk about science advisors and institutions, universities, academies, and so on, like providing information to policymakers in more or less structured ways. But like I said earlier, politicians are also citizens. And they're not only exposed to specialist scientific advice, they're often also engaged, often extremely engaged, sometimes too engaged, we might say, with social media and the public discourse. So do we have evidence of policy, so not just political debate, but actual policy being influenced by this kind of dynamic? So two questions, sorry. One, how do policymakers get their news? Is it like the rest of us? And two, have we seen policy decisions being influenced by this dynamic on social media that we've been discussing?
Yeah, this is part of the like 24/7 news cycle where the number of sources is just increasing, but policymakers, just like everybody, get their news from just so many different sources, whether directly from news outlets or social media, or from their resources like their staffs. Many have communications staffs or communication professionals who work with them, who aggregate the news and compile it and give them the highlights every day. Policymakers and politicians can also get their news indirectly from constituents, for example, or from witnesses in government hearings. So there are so many different ways that policymakers can get their news. And to the second question, have we seen examples where misinformation from social media or from the internet has made its way into policy? I definitely think that misinformation online is affecting the policymaking process, whether it's because misinformation can add legitimacy or spread faster or reinforce these claims that we're seeing offline, like climate change is a hoax, for example, or claims around COVID-19 or claims around government benefits, like whether it adds like that legitimacy or reinforces those beliefs. And then,
yeah,
I think, yeah.
Okay, I don't know if you have any evidence, or if not, then I guess I just ask, what's your impression? Like, what's going on in these situations? Is it that you have a policymaker who is persuaded that something untrue is true because of what they see in the social media ecosystem? Or is it that you have politicians who already believe the untrue thing, or at least make it part of their political identity to insist on it, let's put it that way, and so the ecosystem picks it up and amplifies that and reinforces it?
I think both. I mean, we have seen that some policymakers have been very online. For example, like the past U.S. President Donald Trump, who's used Twitter as a platform quite often, both to express himself and to directly communicate with his voter base. But also we saw that the former President Trump would also retweet other things and also appear to be quite online and to reference things that he saw online. So I definitely think it's possible that even exposure to misinformation online, whether or not it makes its way into government policy, can have the effect of adding legitimacy or even just normalizing some of the claims that we're seeing. I think that some of the biggest effects of misinformation really are to reinforce some of the ongoing claims that we've seen. For example, around climate change or around gun control. And this is something that Congress has not taken a significant amount of action on over the past few decades for many reasons. But in recent years, we have seen a lot of conspiracy theories essentially saying that recent incidents of gun violence are hoaxes. We've seen that some politicians actually have engaged with some of these conspiracy theories, essentially downplaying the impacts of gun violence. And we have seen that some of these same politicians have opposed efforts to curb gun violence or to mitigate climate change in Congress. So to your question, have we seen examples of misinformation making its way into policy? We've seen misinformation preventing policy from happening, which is equally as impactful as misinformation actually becoming government policy.
Yeah, that's a very good point. But so then I have two questions. Firstly, you have an audience now largely made up of people who work at the science policy interface, or who study it, or who take a deep interest in it. So how can we help to improve the situation? What can we do when we're interacting with policymakers representing a scientific perspective, say, to counteract or at least kind of be aware of this broader context we've been describing? And then the second question is I'm sure one you think about every day in your line of work, which is what needs to be done in general, what needs to change in society as a whole to improve this situation, to get a more healthy information space and get more evidence and science into public debate and into policy?
Yeah, those are really good questions. I do think it's so important for policymakers, especially, to use reliable sources, just because they have, I mean, such an outsized impact, more power than the average citizen will ever have when it comes to affecting people's lives. I should also add that misinformation spread by policymakers is more damaging because people trust policymakers. Going back to that Lysol example that of Donald Trump, like what people say matters. So I think, first of all, we need to ensure that reliable information is available. And that seems like a really basic step. But actually, we are seeing that the availability of trustworthy sources has diminished. Like, we are seeing the shrinking academic and civic space, whether that's because scientific agencies aren't always getting the funding that they need, same with like a free and diverse press. We are seeing that this lack of funding, this lack of advertising dollars is harming a lot of local news agencies and even causing many to shut down. And then also with academic research, like there has been a lot of academic research on science and technology topics, but funding is always an issue. And there are also other administrative and various other hurdles that academic researchers, that independent researchers, including at think tanks, and then others in the civic space face when it comes to providing this accurate information. So policymakers really need to ask themselves, like, A, what can we do to ensure that these sources are robust, that they're available, that they have the support they need, but then at the same time also making sure that they remain independent and that government isn't overreaching or affecting their independence in any way. And then second, I think in addition to making sure that the reliable information is available, also making sure mechanisms exist to provide advice to policymakers specifically. And I see this at CSIS, where CSIS as a think tank, we have multiple audiences. Like, we put out content to communicate important issues to the general public, but we also have a separate audience, which is policymakers. We want to make sure our work is extremely relevant to policymaking itself. So I think second, making sure mechanisms exist to provide advice to policymakers that is reliable and trustworthy. And this probably sounds very familiar to you at the scientific advice mechanism, but making sure that these platforms are there, that they have the funding and they have the resources that they need is just so important.
I have one more question for you, and it's about science communication in general, and not just to policymakers, but to society in general. Are there features that we should be trying to build into our communications that will make them either, I guess, less susceptible to being misunderstood or to being used in disinformation, misinformation campaigns, or that will just help them cut through and compete better with the less reliable kinds of sources we've been talking about?
I think that's a great question. And it's not an easy task, right? Because oftentimes a lot of the science and technology topics that we talk about are so complex. I think features that we can build in is, first of all, using accessible language for people, really translating, really defining and explaining some of the terminology that we see that isn't always intuitive for general audiences or for policymakers that are often grappling with dozens of topics at a time. Second, I think it's really important to explain not only what is happening, but why it matters. So, like, we're seeing these trends in carbon emissions, but what does that mean for people? Like, what does this mean? Like, what will the world look like 5 years from now or 10 years from now? What do we predict? And then third, I think it's also really great to be able to summarize or just to pull like the key points. Like, what are the three or four points that people really, really need to know? Just breaking that down for people in very manageable ways, I think are great ways to make sure that people have the information that they need to make policy or to understand and to vote, like, and to really engage with some of the huge science and technology issues that we're seeing today.
That's great. Thank you. I think apart from that very practical advice right there, it's valuable for people who work at the science policy interface to, as it were, come up for air now and then and think a bit about the broader news and information ecosystem, I keep using that word today, oh well, that they operate in, and that the policymakers who receive their advice are often very deeply embedded in. Otherwise, we can sometimes respond with kind of puzzlement when our well-thought-through advice doesn't land in the way we feel it should. So, Caitlin Chin Rothman, thank you very much indeed for spending time with me talking through these issues.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Toby, for having me. It was really great talking to you.
The Science for Policy podcast is created by the Scientific Advice Mechanism to the European Commission. It's produced and presented by Toby Wardman, with additional editing by Nina Skorczak. The scientific advice mechanism provides evidence-based expertise and policy recommendations to inform policymaking in the European Commission. This podcast is funded by the EU via the SAPEA Consortium. Our theme music is composed by Carlo Alfredo Piatti and performed by Elisaveta Shushenko.